following is a previously broadcast program.
On Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Jalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
So earlier today, on February 24th, I spoke with Ilya, a Russian anarchist living and organizing in Kiev, Ukraine. We spoke about the relationship between Russia and Ukraine, the history of the Maidan uprising and the war in the Donbass, resistance to the invasion of Ukraine and the Putin regime from within Russia by Russian anarchists, conspiracy theories about Ukraine promoted by Russia and Russian-aligned media outlets, critiques of the Ukrainian state, and anarchists choosing their own path of self-defense and revolutionary mutual aid in the face of invading armies. You can learn more following anarchists organizing resistance on the ground in Ukraine, as well as finding out how to donate to their initiatives and share your solidarity by visiting their link tree. It's linktr.ee/operation.solidarity as the bombs are dropping in Ukraine. No war but the class war, y'all.
Would you please introduce yourself with whatever name, preferred gender pronouns, location, or political affiliations that make sense for this conversation?
Yes, my name is Ilya. I am an anarchist from Russia, currently living in Kiev and staying in Kiev.
I'd like to ask you a bit about what's been going on in Ukraine for the last few months with international tensions, but I kind of feel like a brief rundown of the sort of the relationship between Ukraine historically and with Russia would be kind of helpful. Could you speak a little bit about the historical relationship or the Soviet Union as it was at one point? What sort of like emotional or nationalist claims does Russia make for occupying Crimea or for occupying Ukraine?
Oh, yes, sure. We have some like big tensions from the autumn, but it also happened through past several years, several times already, where some threat of war was believed to be in the air. As we see only now, it really came into reality in full scale. So this is, the strategy of blackmailing and of pressure, which was made by Putinist government on the local authorities, also on local system. And relations are very bad between two countries since 2014, since after Maidan protests of 2013-14 and removal of the pro-Russian president Yanukovych, Russia invaded Crimea and annexed it, and also invaded Donbas region, using some more loyalty of part of local population to Russia. So historically, I guess maybe is not make a lot of sense to go really deep into historical context. We can say briefly that in the very old times, like maybe around 1,000 and or 700 years ago, Ukrainians and like today Ukrainians and Russians and then just Eastern Slavic peoples were a part of a common political entity and also of common linguistic groups, like we are all still Eastern Slavic group, both Russians, Ukrainians and Belarusians, which speak pretty close languages. But then the historical ways, they really separated for some reasons. And then by the end, like it started already in 17th century and finished in late 18th century when territory of modern Ukraine was incorporated into Russian Empire. And since then, we can speak actually about colonization of local territories by Russian Empire. With the Soviet Revolution labels, they changed. It was declared the equality of peoples and also internationalism as the main policy, but still actually we can say that Soviet Union in many aspects were still very imperial designed state with the center in Moscow, with the predominance of Russian language, and with the many different ways centered political and economical system into Moscow, into Russia. So after Soviet Union collapsed, all the republics which constructed Soviet Union in general. They got actual in state independence, but then after Putin came into power in 1999, he started this, I would say, neo-imperialist or neo-colonizational politics of restoring the Russian state influence on the former Soviet Union area. And his politics about helping pro-Russian presidents to come into power, like was with Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine, and then harsh reaction on the situations when these presidents would be thrown away from power, especially by the popular uprising, which was Maidan uprising. It was even not electoral process. It was really a popular movement which threw Yanukovych away and overthrew him. So since then, I think we can start a today period, like modern stage of Ukrainian-Russian relations are started exactly in 2014 with the Yanukovych flee and Crimea annexation.
Like, there's definitely some people in the quote-unquote anti-imperialist left in other parts of the world that are saying that the territorial integrity of Russia and its border is being threatened by the de facto participation of Ukraine in the EU or relationship to the European Union or relationship to NATO, as if Ukraine is necessarily, it's either a part of the Russian Federation in the restoration of historical Russia or historical Soviet Union of the Stalin era, or it is gobbled up and controlled as a puppet state by the European Union and by NATO, by Western capitalist powers or imperialist powers. So I'd like, I'm sure a lot of our conversation is going to sort of play with that idea and break it down. But can you talk about that idea or how that relates to the Maidan movement and the annexation of the Donbas and Crimea and sort of what's happened in those territories?
Yes. So maybe first we can touch this nationalist sentiment, which you mentioned previously. Because our peoples, Ukrainians and Russians, are historically close and also linguistically and culturally close. And also by the years of some imperialist rule, it was comparatively easy widespread of usage of Russian language around here, especially eastern and southern parts of the country. They speak predominantly Russian. And this gives space for speculations that actually we are like one people, like, for example, Putin likes to speculate, and that there is somehow historical reasons for our so-called geopolitical integrity, which is, of course, just a propagandistic tool for some authoritarian power with some geopolitical ambitions to use this, these historical and cultural toys for their own benefit to make some speculative ground for their invasions. So if we then jump to this problem of NATO and EU bringing Ukraine into the zone of influence by NATO and the European Union, of course, it really takes place, especially since 2014, because new authorities which came into power after Maidan uprising, they were clearly pro-Western. It is also hard to deny that a lot of locals have some pro-Western sentiment, because for people in Eastern Europe and in all post-Soviets, Western world still creates somehow a role model of lifestyle, I would say, because European Union is very close and is not that culturally distant, and still they have this, nice and comfortable Western life. And many people think that, like in our regions, not only in Ukraine, in Belarus, in Russia as well, in every corner of post-Soviet space, people dream about having a life like this. This is also a matter to be used by some political manipulators of so-called pro-Western orientation. And Ukraine is not an exclusion or even a bright example of it. However, still, any expansion of NATO and European Union is actually superficial, because there were no really even suggestions or proposals for the Ukraine to join these organizations. So this, let's say, very chimerical, artificial threat for Russian statehood once again is used as a tool to justify pressure and invasion. These attempts to make, as you said already before, Ukraine a puppet state for Putin's regime, or to wage war like we see it today.
You've mentioned that there are more people in the East and the South who speak Russian, maybe are in the Orthodox Church, or in some ways like identify with Russia. Can you say a few words about the quote-unquote people's republics in Donetsk and Luhansk and their relationship to Russia? Like, the Duma just asked Putin to recognize the independence of these states, and he said that it was years late, that he should have done this before. But to your understanding, is there any truth that these are republics?
How to say, Ukrainian society is very multi-layer in cultural aspects. So linguistic affiliations, as well as religious affiliations, they not necessarily at all construct some political loyalties, especially in terms like pro-Russian or pro-Western. Yes, southern and eastern regions, they are very Russian-speaking, but no way at all that majority of the people, or even considerable number of the people, they support the integration with the Putinist Russia. Like, no way, it's just not like this. Also, Orthodox Church here is separated into different factions. So, like, we have here both the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and also Ukrainian branch of Moscow Orthodox Church. This separation somehow influenced the political loyalties, but also not fully. Like, even if person is Russian speaking and go into Ukrainian branch of Moscow Orthodox Church, it doesn't necessarily means that this person loyal to Russian government. But still, yes, in Crimea and in eastern and southern regions, there are more sympathizers for Russian state and also for Putinist regime. And for example, so-called oppositional platform, the party which is still present in Ukrainian parliament, it holds clearly pro-Putin positions and is still mostly supported in southern and eastern areas, but by no way by the majority of the population. So what I want to say briefly, that a lot of people who speaks mostly Russian here, they still by no way want to be integrated in some new Russian, new empire, or to be subjugated by Putin's regime. This from the start. And about the political nature, like Crimea is another story. Like, a lot of people, I would say, actually associated themselves with Russia in this territory, but also far from being the social consensus in Crimea about it. For example, indigenous people of Crimea, which is Crimean Tatars, they are in a very big numbers. They are really not happy and disloyal to the so-called new authorities in Crimea. They even try to resist somehow to it. So there is also a split within Crimean community, I would say, would be correct to say. And about so-called popular republics, of course, they are not republics at all. They could never exist without direct support from the Russian state, both in economical conditions and, more important, by military conditions. So, of course, we need to say that there is some support from the grassroots for this republic, but is not even nearly enough to hold any anti-Ukrainian separatist insurgency. So this is not authentic separatist movement, actually. This is really totally orchestrated by Russian state and military. So this is no republics at all, actually. This is, I would say, really criminal quasi-states ruled by some sort of mafias, which is called governments of these so-called republics. And these mafias, they hold the power since they are fully controlled and fully loyal and fully manipulated by Kremlin.
In the past month, and particularly, it's been escalating. You've seen more than 100,000 Russian troops along the eastern border with Ukraine, the participation in impromptu drills and war games involving tens of thousands of aligned Belarusian troops to the north, naval deployments in the sea south of Ukraine, and the activation of troops in occupied Moldova. There have even been nuclear training exercises in recent days. And as I'm hearing, there's been shelling already in the Donbass, but I've heard that shelling has actually started in other parts of Ukraine, the parts that aren't occupied. There's also this issue that Western governments and the Ukrainian government saying Russia is going to do a false flag activity to claim a reason to do an invasion. And there was, in fact, a car bomb of the head of security forces in one of the quote-unquote People's Republics that Russia was claiming was a terrorist act and an activity by the Ukrainian government. I guess we've sort of already talked about how this is just Russian expansion. Is there any sort of activity, any sort of truth to these what's been called false flag activities or the claims of active genocide in the eastern part of the country against Russian-speaking peoples, which the Putin administration regime has been using as an argument of why they needed to defend them?
First of all, you are absolutely correct. Today early morning, we got up because every parts of Ukraine were actually bombed by the heavy airstrikes from Russian side. As far as I can estimate up to now, their main target were both civil and military airports and also other military targets. But they bombed pretty near to the civil inhabited places. And as far as I know, up to now, dozens of civilians already killed by Putinist forces from the sky. About your question, like, by no way I want to whitewashing the Ukrainian state. First of all, like, I would not call Ukrainian state like super nationalist, even though this is, of course, classic nation state, actually, with all its obvious shortcomings and also with some politics for ethnic and national unification, which is unjust, of course. So what else should be said about it? That this is also very neoliberal and poor state, like providing continuously and extensively neoliberal reforms, which are reducing social help and safety for the working people, for the just like poor people of this country. And some nationalist sentiment, of course, is present in this society. Some people believe that people here should speak only Ukrainian language, that because the Russian language were absolutely colonizers one. But this is, of course, nonsense from my point of view, because millions of Ukrainians prefer Russian language. All this creates splits within the society create tensions and create a space for some political advances of certain political forces. But of course, there is no ethnic cleansing. There is no genocide. This is like absolutely over exaggeration, which is used consciously by Russian forces, by Putinist forces, even I would prefer to say, to play this card of military invasion and of their political expansion. There is no, how to say, forcibly making people to speak another language, for example, and there is no some like really repression and violence against people who maybe not that much fit to Ukrainian nation state frame. Like, there are certain problems, of course, but what we see today is just an attempt to over-exaggerate all the problems and to instrumentalize these problems for clearly imperialist aggression. We just now curfew is declared in Kyiv since 10 p.m., but we still have a lot of time before it. Okay.
Do you have any sort of sense? So we see, I mean, with the air raids, with the bombings that are happening, like, it's clear that Russia is not just about saber rattling, which a lot of people were proposing beforehand, that it was more about getting international attention and proving itself that it can destabilize the Ukrainian economy and bring a lot of other world powers to the table. This was kind of an assumption of Putin's logic. But at this point, obviously, it's more than that. And a lot of people were saying beforehand that it didn't seem likely that Putin's or that the Russian regime would end up invading because the military force that they could muster probably wouldn't be enough to actually occupy Ukraine, between the all of the aid that's been coming internationally, the buildup of NATO and U.S. troops in neighboring countries, the training of the Ukrainian population in like civil defense forces that seem to be preparing for the possibility of guerrilla warfare against an occupation. But all of that aside, Russia's doing what it's doing right now. Trying to figure out what was going on with the Russian administration and where their decision making was that helpful, do you think, or was that kind of a distraction to actually preparing for the real possibility of what we're seeing now?
Well, if I understood your question correctly, I would think that Russian government, like, I am far from thinking that they are like stupid or crazy or something, but somehow they are really going wild because they feel that they are somehow facing the final battle now. Like, they lose popularity within Russia, actually, and they need some more doping, I would say, to make it increase again internal popularity. They also feel that so-called international community is actually weak and fragmented, and they try to use these holes within this international community and with this world establishment consensus to make some game change and to provide their authoritarian interests. Like, I think we can compare it fairly good with the behavior of Turkish state, which has their own, let's say, popular republics in Syria, for example, and also extending their influence abroad its borders. So I think these two neo imperialist states, they make actually very similar politics. So for me, it seems that they understand, and also we need to remember that since 2014, when European sanctions were imposed, the economical situation in Russia is worsening from year to year, which also contributes to growing unpopularity of this regime in Russian minds, I would say. Because of this, I think that Russian authorities feel themselves like still very powerful, and they are actually, but at the same time, they feel themselves a little bit, you know, like in Ragnarok, like in some final battle for them to protect their privileged position and their full control over the country and abroad. And that is the reason why I think they play such wild games, both inside and abroad Russia.
Are you aware of anti-militarist opposition inside of the Russian Federation? Like, this building conflict has been simultaneous to Russia aiding the suppression in Belarus by Lukashenko, as well as putting down the Kazakh unrest.
Yes, I am. I know that a lot of people in Russia don't like war at all. I know this. I'm pretty sure about this. This is obvious for me. At the same time, you need to know that all political opposition, both from liberal, far right, and anarchist leftist side, were extensively smashed during last years. For example, probably you heard even in US about so-called network case against Russian anarchists, and a lot of different cases were going like this. So they also killed oppositional leaders like liberal leader Boris Nemtsov. They now imprisoned Alexei Navalny, which one of the biggest populist liberal leaders in Russian opposition. So they did work well to distract all the opposition forces. Since 2011, we had several sparks, I would say, sparks of resistance, of protest, really broad protest movements, but they didn't succeed finally. They were more or less co-opted or smashed by the state, or they just died because time passed away and they still gained no results. And after each of these sparks, the government used their opportunity to suppress more and more the opposition. One big last increase of the protests we saw last winter in January 2021 when this populist Navalny returned to Russia, and many of his supporters, but also even more of just people unhappy with the situation in the country, they really came to the streets to in many, many Russian cities to protest the Putin politics. But they all were suppressed, and then repressions became even harder, and tens of people were imprisoned. So now human rights defenders speak about at least 1,000 of political prisoners in Russia. And we need to know that actually there are many more, because human rights defenders, they do not recognize all the people who are being imprisoned for their political activities. Because of this now, there are a lot of unhappiness with this war in Russia, but there is no organizational tools, some movement tools, which could mobilize the people of Russia to protest against it. We already saw today several separate actions against the invasion and against the war in Russia, in different cities of Russia, but it's still not a massive organized movement. For example, we see no big demonstrations as far as I know. I still hope to see them, and maybe if war continues, it will happen, but up to today, it doesn't exist because this government made a conscious work to destroy any internal opposition. But still, you know, for example, it's interesting that when coronavirus vaccination started, this anti-vax movement, they got also big grounds in Russian society, and authorities even had to make several steps back with this vaccination and certifications programs, because even like you hardly expect from Putin and from Russian authorities to have any steps back. But that time they made, because they really saw a big unhappiness growing within the population. So I still far from thinking they are almighty, even internally, not at all. Like this is some, how to say, some ghost of protest and revolutionary movement within Russia, which still didn't take its forms, but it definitely is present, it definitely exists. And this is one of the factors which make Putinist government so wild to make such initiatives, let's say, as they do today.
Kind of on a side note, and a question that I have in relation to COVID in Russia is, in the West, like, media has represented protests concerning or a lot of experience and a lot of a lot of protests around COVID to be around a distrust of the quality of the shots that the Russian government was making. And maybe that's a misrepresentation, and maybe it actually is the anti-vax overall, in similar conspiracy theory ways that we have in the West too. But is there any truth to that? Like, what do you think was motivating the anti-vax movement in Russia?
Well, I think there is actually a lot of, this so-called COVID skepticism, and a little bit of being skeptical about medicine as well, which we can treat as some sort of ignorance, which actually exists within the population. But at the same time, another portion of this anti-vax motivation, which maybe differs it from what we have in the West, but I may be mistaken, is that Russian population is highly, it doesn't believe the authorities. It doesn't believe that from above will come any good. They want to resist any invasion of the state programs within their private lives, because they know that there are a lot of lies going from TV channels and from the first highest persons of the state. They used to experience many tricks from this side, and because of it, they just don't believe the authorities. And this was one of the factors for anti-vax sentiments blossom in Russia.
The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero. The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero network of anarchist podcasts. And here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
Are you tired of listening to Western experts talking how the world works?
Isn't it a portion of liberal analysis of the uprising makes you fall asleep?
Well, then check Elephant in the Room, an anarchist radio show from European Dresden, where we interview activists who are participating in struggles around the world.
Elephant in the Room is a proud member of Channel Zero Network. You can find our show on your favorite podcast platforms, CZN website, or somewhere on the internet.
From activists?
For activists.
So as I understood, the Maidan protests in part were a push against the rule by Ukrainian oligarchs, although maybe it was in favor of some oligarchs over others. And they had like a vast controls in many ways parallel to the Russian oligarchs who Putin rules alongside. Some people, at least, who are arguing against the Russian invasion are positing it as supporting Ukraine. You've already laid a critique that it's a poor neoliberal state, a capitalist state. Can you talk a little bit more breaking apart these ideas of being against the invasion and in favor of self-defense of the population versus supporting Ukraine as a political project or state?
Yes, I do it with pleasure, actually, because this is, I believe, the most important point, actually. But first of all, some preliminary words, like actually Russian system and Ukrainian system are very different, because all the Russian oligarchs, they are more or less subjugated to this unified authoritarian rule of Putin and his clique, which originates more in former Soviet secret services, which is Putin is former worker of. So this is pretty unified model of control from one center, which is this we call siloviks. I know that even in the West, this word is in usage now, like with this secret services political center. In Ukraine, situation is another. There is really competing oligarch clans struggling for power and for bigger zones of economical and political influence. You absolutely correct. Maidan uprising had a lot of anti-oligarchical intention, because this oligarchical rule is really something which makes this country very poor and vulnerable. At the same time, surprisingly, both countries are absolutely neoliberal. Like, even though Putin has some social populism, he year after year, for decades now already, he provides neoliberal reforms and also, strengthening social vulnerability of the working people, of the ordinary people. And a Ukrainian state, not Ukrainian state, but Ukrainian society is still much less state controlled. That is important point. Is not like Ukrainian state is no better than other states, but it just has much less tools to confront, to control, and to subjugate its own population. This is still somehow pluralistic, like absolutely unlike the Russian situation. And I would say still there is still much more free atmosphere around here. Like, this is not a coincidence that, for example, many comrades from Russia and Belarus, they find shelter exactly here. Because much less political repression and state violence is present here. So here we still see a lot of grounds for making some grassroots initiatives, direct democracy projects, and any, I would say, even social revolutionary developments. While in Russia, we see just this authoritarian hammer, I would say, which smash everything which it meets in its way. So this is one of the big reasons why it needs to be confronted. Ukrainian state has a lot of disadvantages, but Ukrainian society really should be protected from this totalitarian threat it faces today, and actually faces already decades before, since Putinist expansionist politics are starting to be implemented. So this is exactly our reason why to participate in it. We believe in radical social changes within Ukrainian society, but for this, exactly for this, not for protecting some state sovereignty, which doesn't make sense for us. Exactly for possibility for positive social changes, Putinist invasion should be severely confronted. And I would say that this is the moment of truth When, like, you know, in such war situations, very often grassroots ties and self-organization, solidarity, mutual aid, they really take grounds within the population, especially when elites betray, when, you know, like several days before the invasions, many poor politicians of Ukraine, they just flew away on their private jets. So we see pretty clearly that state is not a friend at all for the Ukrainian people. So this is our fight. Our fight is for the people, is for protecting the grounds for the future revolutionary changes, which is now being deadly threatened by the Putinist threat.
So one of the conspiracy theories that has been promoted by authoritarians in the so-called anti-imperialist left, often not promoting leftist values and social justice, but often aligned with the Russian regime and others viewed as being oppositional to the USA, has been that the Maidan movement was a CIA operation to promote the far-right groups such as Privy Sector or Svoboda taking power in a bloodthirsty drive to ethnically cleanse Russians in the Donbas. Can you talk about this view of what happened, or this view of the Ukrainian state or culture in terms of the far-right influence?
Yes, well, as the good teacher of this authoritarian propagandist Goebbels said, that if you want your lies to be believed in, you should use some corns of truth in it. So yes, the far rights, they really had a strong presence in Maidan uprising, because they were organizing pretty well before it, like 4 years before it, and also was somehow affiliated with the authorities and with the secret services, as far as we can estimate, and also with some criminal business and so on. Because of this, they faced this Maidan uprising in, I would say, pretty good fit, which gave them an opportunity to develop somehow their organizations within Maidan uprising and after it. But still, like, in first approach, this is the lie that Ukrainian far rights took more grounds for ethnical cleansing of Russian-speaking population, because there is still no actually ethnical cleansing of this population. And also, really far-right nationalist parties, they are even not presented in parliament. But more important, like, because honestly, I don't give a lot of shit, like, who is present in parliament, but more important for me, when I participated in Maidan uprising, I saw by my own eyes hundreds of thousands of just ordinary people, of grassroots people, rebelling against the oligarchical rule, against the humiliation imposed by the uncontrollable criminal president Yanukovych imposed on them. This was really, like, of course, many powers tries to intervene and tried to influence this, not only far right. We was liberals, some fake oppositional parties created by different local oligarchs clans, which we already mentioned today. All of them tried their best to influence their movement. And I would say, like, oligarch Poroshenko, which became next president, pretty succeeded in it. And we can say that Maidan is once again a betrayed revolution, like revolution which was stolen from the people by the oligarchs. But the Maidan uprising itself were definitely less of nationalist movement and much more of grassroots popular movement against the authorities, against the government. This I would say.
Yeah, and that, I mean, that makes absolute sense. When I think to something similar in the United States, like the Occupy movement, in some areas it was all sorts of different people coming for their own political reasons to be in that space, because they had shared experience of misery under capitalism and alienation. And in some places, the Democratic Party was able to harness some of the energy. It definitely tried all over to either harness it or destroy it if it couldn't. States, and also, the relationship between the far right and security forces is ubiquitous and international. So, but on the same topic, can you talk about the participation of groups like Azov Battalion in fighting since the, you know, at least in the war in the Donbas that's been happening since 2014, the training of far-right foreigners and paramilitary skills, and the allowance of their existence in or alongside of the armed forces in the Ukrainian military?
Oh, yes. Azov Voluntary Battalion was formed soon after Maidan and was really like Nazi initiative to intervene this conflict on Donbas. Soon after, they became a regular regiment of Ukrainian army and somehow integrated within military hierarchy. So now they are not like clearly political, because still a part of army, which is declared to be apart from any politics. But of course, as a Nazi originated, like Nazi built structure, these people, like Nazis, they really still have like core presence in there and leadership within it. I have no like strict information, but I heard many rumors, but from believable sources, that yes, lots of Western Nazis came, and also from Russian Nazis, actually, even more from Russian Nazis, they came here to participate in Azov and also to train. This is, yes, this really exists, and not only Azov Battalion, they organized their civil branch, which is called National Corps Party, which like intervenes actively in Ukrainian political life, but also very much discredited because its affiliation with criminal activities and also affiliation with the Interior Ministry of former Interior Minister Avakov. And all this is called the Azov Movement, which is pretty far-right movement. Even though now trying to play somehow that we are not Nazis, we are not fascists, we are just conservative nationalists, but like originally they are really Nazis. They are really in. Still, I have honestly no information about any ethnic cleansing of them being performed. Like surprisingly, many Nazis here, for example, Dmytro Yarosh from Pravyi Sektor you mentioned, they originate, or many of National Corps, like Dmytro Yarosh is from Dnieper City, and many of National Corps leaders, they are from Kharkiv, like from eastern cities which are predominantly Russian speaking. So here you can have a lot of Russian speaking Nazis actually. So when somebody tries to portray that this is Ukrainian speaking population against Russian speaking population, this is a pure hoax and tricks. So yes, as I said already before, Nazis are present a lot in local political life. This is true, but they are still much more weak than, for example, just oligarchical forces. Like they are visible, they are hearable, but when somebody tries to manipulate that Ukraine is somehow Nazi state, fascist state, this is of course, this is just a lie. This is just not true. And this is just a tool of manipulation for pro-Putinist forces, which unfortunately took grounds also in Western so-called anti-imperialist movement, because really anti-imperialist movement needs to be today with us here confronting this purely imperialist aggression.
It seems like the opportunity is present with the recognition that Nazis have been able to organize, far right has been able to organize, and also that the Putinist forces are simultaneously like trying to, they're taking ground quite literally. It seems like an opportunity for anarchists and anti-authoritarian anti-capitalists to reach out to their neighbors, as provide alternatives, offer what you mentioned with like mutual aid and also coordinating. Obviously, like people tried to do that during the Maidan and got outflanked basically. Can you talk about the situation of anarchist and anti-authoritarian movement in Ukraine at the moment? Like I just saw messages this morning about on social media of many anarchists who had to flee Belarus, for instance, to Ukraine, deciding to stay and to try to like defend the population against invasion. And it seems like a lot of people are sort of hunkering down and making that decision to stay. Can you talk about what that anarchist movement looks like?
Yes, of course. I would say that Maidan was a really hard blow and the source of depression for anarchist movement, because it provided a lot of splits, like about attitude and position about Maidan. Some comrades took one ground, other comrades took another one, and this provided a lot of quarrels. But even more was the negative influence that Maidan actually appeared as this betrayed revolution, as I already said before. Some people really believed that it will lead to some positive political changes, but it leads, like, hardly led to any of good changes within the society. So anarchist movement, and I would say leftist movement in general, found itself in depression in Ukraine for years. But several last years, I think we can speak about restoring movement, because a lot of old participants and also new participants as well, they really are making some analytical work, what needs to be done for the movement to reconstruct itself, to organize better, and which alternatives we can provide for the society. Of course, we need to confront a lot this nationalist sentiment, like about our state of Ukraine. This national sentiment, of course, is widespread within the society. This pro-Western sentiment I already mentioned, like of people dreaming of a good Western-like life. This is something we really need to work with and fight with. But this is possible. And of course, this gray zone of Europe, this weak state, because Russia looks pretty stable, even though I believe that it's not like this actually. Like, I don't know good English words for it, but Russian Putinist regime is something super big, which will collapse very fastly finally. But this is like my belief. European Union, of course, looks as well pretty stable. And Ukraine is not like this. So of course, this is naturally the ground for the grassroots organizing and for some really very different political alternatives to be developed and presented, including our ones.
So I guess in your view, and I know you've kind of addressed this already, but how have anarchists abroad been reacting to these developments? Not knowing what's coming for sure, but I mean, since the shelling's already started, it seems kind of clear, but the situation might change. What forms of solidarity would you like to see coming from abroad? For instance, CrimeThink just put out a tweet about calling for tonight at 7 p.m. or 6 p.m. everywhere for there to be demonstrations at Russian embassies. Is this one of the things that you'd like to see? Is there more than that that you would like to see?
Oh, yes. First of all, I want to greet my comrades in Moscow, which held yesterday the actions against the invasions. It was anarchists who organized them, and several were arrested. It means that actually anarchist comrades and some anti-war actions, they actually exist in Russia already. So the situation here now is actually, first of all, is a challenge for us. Will we be able to develop the narrative, the concept of libertarian participation, like meaningful participation in this anti-imperialist resistance? Like, it needs to be anti-imperialist resistance with some really social revolutionary goals and prospects. Also, the next challenge to us, if we will be able to form our structures, both in forms in terms of self-defense and of civil organizing. And as long as we will be able to do it, we need growing support informationally and also by the actions of solidarity, and also maybe by some material support, of course, from our Western comrades. So any expression of solidarity already now is extremely appreciated and extremely needed throughout all the world. If you want to make graffiti, do it. If you want to make demonstration against a rational Belarusian embassy, do it. This is also a good point to support anarchist political prisoners, which are a lot both in Russia and Belarus. If you want to collect some money, do it. If you want to spread our information, which I hope will be extensively translated, like published first and translated into English as well, this is also a very good way to express your solidarity. So I believe solidarity actions, media informational help, and also providing material support and infrastructural support for us, for anarchist movement here, for libertarian movement here, would be really good grounds for us to rely on.
I guess one more question is, so, and this is sort of, I've seen this discussed a little bit, not the perspectives of people in Ukraine, but other anarchists elsewhere talking about the difficulty of being engaged in or around official state organizations of defense while keeping autonomy and keeping an anti-state, so pro-social perspective. Can you talk a little bit about that balance and what sort of discussions anarchists and anti-authoritarian leftists in Ukraine are having about that?
Yes, I think I can do it. Of course, especially this is the hard question in terms of self-defense, because every authorized self-defense is coming from the state, more or less. So there is a challenge, if we want to have self-defense and not confronting on every front, and we are few, so we need to collaborate somehow with the state military structures. And the question is how not to assimilate to these structures, but still collaborate somehow, having some sort of autonomy and our own vision and perspective. Well, I don't want to lie to say that we have perfect plan how to do it, but definitely we realize this problem, and we work and find some, I would say, tricky ways to do it, like to really have self-defense as much independent from the state structures as possible. I think this is what really political movements should do. Like we see it a lot in Kurdistan, for example, this maneuvering to protect their own perspective and sovereignty. And this is at least in much less scales than in Kurdistan, but in principle is the same what we are trying to do here. Another important problem is, I would say, ideological assimilation to the state discourse, because many people, even who associate themselves with the anarchist movement, starting to say, okay, we are now just need to defend our country. Well, in this situation, to defend your country is pretty good, but this is not enough at all for the anarchist revolutionary. You need to develop some perspective for changes, some ideas on how you want to influence political and social situation within the country. And this is also the matter of discussions, of somehow even very hot discussions, and our continuous thinking here. But more or less, we are, most of us agreeing that we need, within this struggle, anti-imperialist struggle, and our participation in it, we need to express, to develop and express our anarchist narrative and program and ideas.
Thank you so much, Ilya, for having this conversation with me. And we'll be sure to provide the links that comrades in Ukraine have shared to keep up. And I hope that this conversation helps get more people in the streets. And good luck.
Thanks a lot to you. Good luck. We are staying in contact.
Please. Yeah, in solidarity, and share my love with the people there. I'll let you go now, but take care.
Yeah, thanks a lot. We are now here with the comrades, finding our ways to do, and we say, greetings to you. Thanks for your support.
Solidarity.
Solidarity. Ciao.
And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain. What you say? What you say?
The Fark Goblin kidnapping fiasco. You may have noticed that I've been absent for a few weeks. In fact, I still am. You did notice, right? I have to tell you what the Fark Goblins did. It's that crazy. So here's the whole story, and most of it's true. My attorney filed a civil action to stop the Ohio dimwits of retribution and corruption from illegally renditioning me to Maryland. The judge was waiting on my sworn statement to file via snail mail, and she was going to sign an order to keep me here. Well, the Fart Goblins found out. So on February 2nd, they came to my cell at 5:30 a.m. to tell me to pack. This is highly irregular. Pack-ups always happen the night before. But they did this to ambush me, so I couldn't tell my lawyer. So they wanted me to pack up while breakfast was happening, and med count, and mail pickup. Nobody was paying attention as they opened and closed the food slots. And that's how I lost my finger. Yeah, you heard that right. These smooth criminals trying to kidnap me and send me out of state before the judge could stop them accidentally chopped off my finger. They canceled the kidnapping. The hospital couldn't sew it back on. Now I have a nub for right pinky. But wait, there's more! They tested me for COVID. I was positive. And that means the fart goblins had intended to send me across several states, exposing untold innocent people to COVID. ODRC Director Annette Chambers-Smith is willing to commit mass murder to get me out of Ohio. What a wackadoodle. That's like handing out smallpox-infected blankets to clear people off the land. Oh yeah, that's how Ohio was settled. So anyway, returning to the prison, I was stuck in the medical dungeon, not in quarantine block with everyone else who had COVID. I was in med cell block 4, with nothing but a mattress and blankets and sheets. I spent the next 10 days blacksided in place with no property, no on orders of Warden Bowen. I wasn't even allowed to mail out my sworn statement to the court. Of course not. That was the point. They didn't want me to tell the judge that they bungled my kidnapping and tried to send me halfway across the country with COVID. They wanted to hide me from court and counsel. I had no human contact except for staff delivering meds and food. I searched my cell and found a pen under the toilet. So I began writing help messages on the styrofoam trays, asking anyone to call my lawyer and tell him what's up. I got a write-up for that. Yeah, when you try to get around the warden's illegalities, you're wrong. Go figure. Then I got an idea. I had incoming mail, so I had paper. Also, my hand was really bandaged up. Not just the finger, but all the way up to the wrist. So I wrote out my whole story, and I shoved it inside the bandages. On the outside, I put the name and phone number of someone I trust. It said, if you find this, please return to... Then I fell unresponsive in front of the nurse. This was about at 10 p.m. at night. They did vitals. Everything was fine. Did pain response. I didn't respond. The nurse was so heavy-handed, he popped my shoulder. Turns out it was out of socket, and he popped it back in. It felt great ever since. I was awake. They knew I was awake, but I didn't answer. I kept my eyes shut. I didn't move. They took turns squeezing my cuticles and grinding knuckles on my sternum. I didn't respond. Not to brag, but I've got an incredible pain threshold. I didn't even respond to ammonia held under my nose. At about 2 a.m., the ambulance came to take me to St. Elizabeth's. There, the emergency room staff took vitals, looked at my eyes, and knew I was awake. They tortured me. Then grinded knuckles on my sternum until they removed skin. Days later, I had a thick scab about 4 inches long. One nurse, quote, accidentally botched my catheter and sliced the inside of my urethra. I was peeing blood. I didn't move a muscle. One doctor kept lifting my eyelid and poking me in the eye. I didn't budge. They gave me x-rays, a CT scan, nothing abnormal. They knew I was just lying there, eyes closed, not moving, chained to the bed. But I also knew they couldn't send me back until I responded, so I didn't respond. The whole time I was in the ER, there was a special response team with me, 3 guards, one of them a lieutenant, watching me like hawks, so I waited. About 2 p.m., 16 hours of not moving a muscle, I was admitted to the hospital, and they took me up to my room. The nurse dropped my heavy equipment on my testicles. I didn't respond. After grinding my sternum, she joked that it looked like I'd been eating strawberry jello from the blood seeping through my shirt. One of the guards left. That left only 2 of them, and the nurse got them bags of chips and cans of ginger ale. They turned on the TV and started watching Tom Selleck in, quote, Blue Bloods. Fart goblins love Tom Selleck. So quietly, slowly, I reached into the bandages and yanked up the pages I had written there. Just as I suspected, they'd never search me on the way out of the prison. With the 2 special response guys mesmerized by Tom Selleck, I tossed the package down under the bed. I waited a moment, then sat up and announced I had to urinate, and we should get back to the prison. I got a decent hospital meal, and then I was shoved back into the van, back into the medical dungeon. Later that day, someone I trust got a call from St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Youngstown. An intern said, "Hey, we found paperwork in a room upstairs with your name and number on it. Is this yours?" My person said, "Oh, yeah," and then got the intern to transmit it to them. And so, while I was incommunicado, the whole world already knew the details of the botched kidnapping, the violation of COVID protocols, the loss of my finger, and the fact that the Warden Bowen is a corrupt turd who tried to keep me blacksided from courts and counsel, and failed. It was all over the internet, and so 10 days into this, I got my property and transferred to a warm cell in SIG with envelopes and my books. I suspect they don't know what happened until now. I'd love to see their looks, the looks on their faces. So, some lessons to draw from this. First, Far goblins are not just corrupt and brutal, they are also really, really stupid. Second, tolerance to pain is more important than brains when struggling for a better world. Third, whatever you do, don't go to St. Elizabeth's in Youngtown for health care. Those people are assholes. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from the super duper uber mega ultra hypo turbo multi maxi max in Youngstown, Ohio. If you're outsmarting the fart goblins while they watch cop shows, you are the resistance.
You can still write Sean at his new old new again address at Sean Swain number A24320.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.